Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin, joined once again today by Josh Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Project. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, Jim. How you doing?
I'm hanging in there.
Good.
Fine.
Yeah.
Well, you know, all things considered, and there's a lot to consider,
That's true. That's true.
There we are. So we're going to focus today on the latest UT Texas Politics Project polling data, as regular listeners among you might expect. Before we do that, we no way not to acknowledge the dominant political news of the last 24 hours as we record here on late in the morning of September 11th, Thursday. That would be the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. Kirk was shot to death yesterday by, at least at the time of this recording, an unknown assailant during a rally at Utah Valley University. Shortly before we came on today, police found a high-powered bolt-action rifle in the woods near the campus, but still no word on the identity or certainly the apprehension of the assailant. Now, you know, there's a lot to be said, and we'll say it later, I think. It's hard not to think that this is going to be something of an inflection point in American politics, as Josh and I were talking about this morning, particularly given Kirk's closeness to principals in the Trump administration, including the president himself, who issued a statement last night. In what direction this spurs politics and governance in the country, of course, can only be a matter of speculation. And at this point, and I think a lot of that speculation that I've seen, frankly, you know, there's kind of two camps. One, I think, very controlled, the other, very uncontrolled. And I think I'd like to join neither of those camps at this point. So from our vantage point, we just want to note that, you know, our Texas polling data over the last year has continued to demonstrate the concern that that voters have about political violence. And that concern is both widespread and bipartisan. Josh, you did some digging this morning before we came on into our data archive. What did you find?
Yeah, you know, looking back, you know, obviously you've been asking, you know, more questions about political violence over the past five years or so. But looking, you know, more recently, we found that, you know, polling data over the last year in Texas, you know, has shown that voters have concerns about political violence. So in February and June of last year, about 60% of Texans in each survey said that they thought political violence was either very or somewhat likely in response to the 2024 elections. This included similar sized majorities of Democrats, Republicans, and independents. Democrats were slightly more concerned, you know, than were Republicans or independents, but really only slightly. And then last year, as we were moving closer to the election in August and October, just under 3 out of every 4 Texas voters said that they thought political violence in response to the 2024 election was either extremely or very likely. Again, there were significant majorities between 2/3 and 4/5 of Democrats, Republicans, and independents who expected political violence to be a serious problem. So, you know, sadly, you know, Texans have been expressing widespread expectations about, you know, the potential for political violence for some time now.
Yeah, thanks for the quick work on that this morning. We were scrambling a little bit there. As I said earlier, there will, of course, be a lot more to be said about this all as we learn more of the actual facts and see the politics that emerge from this, from the initial, you know, to my mind, almost universal sense of shock and mourning that's emerged from Kirk's killing yesterday. And I, you know, I can't help, I guess my last comment would have to be to, you know, frankly, avoid social media for the next couple of days. And if you don't, you know, not to generalize from the non-representative sample of people that are on the prominent social media platforms. I made the mistake of looking a little bit and almost immediately regretted it, and regretted in a bipartisan fashion. So,
yeah, totally.
I would just, there's a lot more to come on this, and there are lots of things that are deeply troubling about it, and I just really want to wait and see what, learn more about what actually happened, and see what the actual response is. So, okay. You may or may not be able to tell. Our audio crew is so crack. My guess is you can't tell at all, but Josh and I are in different locations today. Josh is in our usual recording location in the audio recording studio in Mezes Hall at UT Austin, with our great technical crew in the audio studio, while I'm at home trying not to spread any more COVID around Austin, which seems already plenty saturated.
That's right.
And I, particularly don't want to spread it to my dedicated colleagues, coworkers, and friends at UT Austin. So with that mise-en-scene set, I have no French at all.
That was great. No, I was going to say, I want to see.
No French at all. I'm just going to chalk that up to the ambition and the execution to being a little sick still. So anyway, with the scene set,
there we
let's
go.
Just say,
there, that's better.
We released the results from our most recent UT Texas Politics Project poll Tuesday, day before yesterday. The poll touched on a lot of topics, with the main, though by no means exclusive, focus being on the agenda for the special session. And I should add that, we'll have another follow-up podcast on the poll next week with our colleague and collaborator, Darren Sean. And that podcast will focus more on sort of the national and election-related results. So let's start with the session results today. And I don't think either of us can promise we won't say at least a little about some of the maybe election relevant stuff, but for the most part, we want to focus on, the big share of the poll that was focused on the special session agenda. Now, Josh, you've taken a stab at this week already in taping what we call our interpreting the news, or unpacking the news.
We
didn't have the brand right. taping our unpacking the news segment for our government 310 intro class we're doing this term. And I thought you took an interesting angle on that with the class, and thanks for covering, since I couldn't be there. So let's try a variation on that theme. Now, the core of the approach we took in the poll was to ask our respondents how they felt about nine areas we adapted from the special agenda as it existed when we conducted the poll, and that was August 22nd. We had to have the poll in the field by August 22nd, so that's kind of a cutoff date for what we could talk about. So why don't you run us through that and start us on some of the results?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, one of the things, that we have to acknowledge at the beginning is that a special session agenda is a choice. And so it's not necessarily the case that this is a reflection of all of the issues that could potentially be on the table, like during the regular session, where we might ask a more open-ended question. It really is what are they doing, and what do voters think about it? And so we have a little more limited universe here, as Jim mentioned. So what we did was, is we said to the voters, as you may know, Governor Greg Abbott recently called a special session of the Texas legislature to address the following items. These are the nine items we talked about. Please tell us how important or unimportant you think it is for the Texas legislature to address each of the following in a special session. So this gives us a sense of essentially how important the voters think it was, for the legislature to be addressing this set of issues. And what we found, looking at the nine was, first and foremost, if you saw the blog post accompanying the poll, there were three that clearly rose to the top. Responding to issues related to the flooding in Central Texas in early July, 55% of voters said that was extremely important for the legislature to address. If you add the share that said it was very important, it's 82% in total. If we take that same approach, adding the extremely and very important responses together, 70% said it was extremely or very important for the legislature to attempt to further reduce property taxes. And 64%, so almost two-thirds, said it was extremely or very important for the legislature to try to prohibit local governments from using public money to pay lobbyists or organizations, essentially taxpayer-funded lobbying for you all. Listen to this. Lower down on the list, we had things like the bathroom bill requiring people to use best restrooms that match their birth, gender, and government in public buildings. 52% thought that was extremely or very important, but only 36% thought it was extremely important. I think that's one notable thing here is, overall, responding to the flooding was at the top. A majority of voters said it was extremely important on its own, and then the shares drop off pretty dramatically. And so when we look at, revising the congressional district maps, which is a big, driver of attention, Only 27% of Texans said that was extremely important. 18% said very, so 45%.
And that's basically the cutoff point for less than half.
Less than half, that's right. Everything
in the extremely very category.
That's correct, right? Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Yeah, so that's where the cutoff is. So the bathroom bill was just above half, saying it was extremely or very. Congressional map, just below, further below. Enacting abortion restrictions, 36%. Eliminating replacing the STAR test, 42%. This is extremely and very. Protecting law enforcement offers from disclosure, 39%. And then, you know, notably, at the very bottom of the list, and we'll probably come back to this, comprehensively regulating hemp-derived products without banning them. Only 14% of Texans said this was extremely important. Only 32% in total said it was extremely or very important. And we can come back to this. But, you know, this was the lack of importance attached was pretty widespread and bipartisan for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in some ways that was when we, you know, there's always this process. We get the data back. You take your first cut. That was one of the first things I noticed, and it kind of persisted as one of the big interesting takeaways.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, ultimately, you know, and I mean, I guess just to go back to it, I mean, the way that I presented this to the class for you all is I looked at sort of flooding, which, you know, I would say passed in large part, although, you know, I left the politics of what did and did not work there out because it's a little too much for that group. We talked about the bathroom bill and we talked about hemp. And one of the things that sort of underlined this, I mean, first and foremost, it's just important to note that, you know, majorities of Republican voters, you know, were generally supportive of most of the policy areas. I mean, or they thought it was important. 85% said it was, you know, extremely or very important to reduce property taxes, 84% to respond to the floods, 82% to require people to use the bathrooms, assigned, you know, based on the genders assigned at birth. So in 7 of the 9 policy areas that we tested, majorities of Republican voters said, yeah, it's either extremely or very important to do that. The only areas where it wasn't the case was enacting new restrictions on abortion access, and that's in part of that's an active ongoing space where the state's made a lot of efforts to restrict access, so there's a little bit less room there. And the other one was, of course, comprehensively regulating hemp-derived products. So again, not seen as important to Republicans. So I mean, the sort of two takeaways, I guess, is one, I'd say the stuff that they were able to pass on the agenda for the most part, you know, it's a mix of things. The flooding, supported by everybody, important to everybody.
Right.
You know, if you look at something like the bathroom bill, you could say, well, this didn't seem that important to voters. Yeah, but it was near the top of the list for Republican voters. And if you go and look just at the voters who say they're the most conservative, the type of voters that we think are going to have an outsized role in the upcoming primaries, it's even higher. And I think it's upwards of 90% when you combine those, say it's extremely and very important. It's like, I think it's 75% said it was extremely important.
And the Democratic number on that was, you know, obviously not majority, but not trivial either, right?
Well, no, and I think this is, you know, we got some light pushback, and it's totally fine, yeah. You know, on that result. And in particular, the fact that, you know, there seem to be Democrats attaching some importance to the bathroom bill. But, you know, the issue here is that if we go and look at our data on people's views about sex and gender, what we find is that a non-trivial minority, but a significant share of Democrats hold a traditional view about the, you know, basically since the a strict definition of gender based on the sex assigned at birth. That has not changed. And so ultimately, you know, that's a little bit of an uphill battle for Democrats, but it's also the case, again, overwhelming support among Republicans. And I, you know, I didn't bring this up in the class, but like this is something that we've been talking about since 2017. This is not like, I mean, at least 2017. So this is not a
right.
new issue. This has been something that's been percolating for a number of years. We've seen them make some efforts in different areas. And so this was not entirely out of left field. And then when we look at something like hemp, what you see is there was, first of all, no voters were saying it was significantly important. That's a big part of this. But also in another question we asked about whether or not the state's marijuana laws should be made more or less strict. And I was thinking about this because the way we asked that question, you could say, well, you know, you attach it to the special session call. So maybe, you know, what you're getting is the fact that people might feel, well, you should really ban it, not regulate it like the governor wants. But when we looked at that other result, what you find is that if you take the first of all, the plurality position, I think, among Republicans right now, and it's almost an equal shares, is to make it less strict. But it's about equal shares, say, make it less strict or more strict. At the same time, if you combine the share who say, make marijuana in Texas, of Republicans who say, make marijuana laws in Texas less strict, and you combine that with the share who say, leave it alone, it's about 55%. And this is to say, it's not a very clear signal. It's not a winning issue for the Republican majority to go in there and essentially say, well, let's pick which one of our voters' positions we want to support on this.
Yeah, I mean, I was really glad that we included, you know, the broader question on marijuana. We went kind of back and forth with this. I think at different points we had a couple more questions, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, because we did want to try to approximate in an intelligible fashion for our respondents,
yeah,
what was on the call, you know, the wording on that, on the item on the legislative agenda did include basically what the essence to our mind, and I think it was fair, of what was on the call, because right, that item did include regulate but not ban, essentially, well, not prohibit. I don't have the language right.
Yeah, no, and that's right. And I think, you know, I made that.
But I think it's good for people to notice that. And you know, it was a, you know, there were a couple of different ways to skin that cat, or we were trying to be consistent.
Well, and I think it's also reflecting the reality here, which is, and I brought this up in the class too, which is that, you know, the governor doesn't get to make them pass anything. He doesn't get to tell them exactly what to pass, but the language that he uses on the call matters, and it dictates, yeah, constraints around what kind of things they're going to be able to address or not. Now, whether or not they decide to follow that or not is obviously an open question. The Senate decided to do what it wanted, but nonetheless, it is the case that, you know, the governor does have the authority and the power to set some guardrails. And so in this case, it makes sense to follow them. But that's also why we asked the follow-up question to be a little bit more comprehensive here. Now, it is notable that, like, the big miss here that's so high on the list is property taxes, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I've been thinking about that a bit just in terms of what's out there in the ether. You know, somebody, I was, you know, noting, for reasons that people will be able to figure out if they know me, that there was a, you know, a Facebook account a couple of days ago of, you know, a pretty big revolt in, up in Coryell County over a proposed, you know, significant, you know, tax increase, mm-hmm, for a property tax increase election. That was really consistent with some of the things that you and I have been talking about, and you've been kind of all over this, mm-hmm, you know, in terms of, you know, people that you might not expect, or areas that you might not expect to be doing this, are saying, well, look, if I have to have an election, and, you know, people are talking about lowering the threshold for the election, I might as well go for it.
Yeah.
Because I believe that, you know, the tax increase, I was seeing that there was a kind of a public meeting that got pretty hot and hostile up there. You know, it was over an increase that I think, you know, was certainly in the double figures. I don't remember what the exact figure was. And, you know, we're seeing similar things in Austin and other places.
Yeah, I think it's one of these really interesting things where the politics of this in the here and now, the policy in the here and now, and the politics in the future just, like, don't line up. Right. So we know from, you know, polling that we've done repeatedly over the years that despite the fact that the legislature has made significant efforts to reduce property taxes. And I think, I mean, like, really, you know, you can put the numbers to it. They have put a huge amount of money behind increasing the homestead exemption. That is an ongoing expense that the state is trying to cover. At the same time, when we ask voters about their expectations about their future property taxes, they're almost certain it's always going to go up, or that the efforts that the legislature make are not going to be very impactful, or that it's not really going to impact their tax bill or whatever. And so voters,
you know, and to be fair, and, you know, in terms of how the legislatures approach it, and when we ask them directly how they think they're doing on right, taxes, you know, they're not giving them an A+.
No, they're, it's usually, you know, near the bottom.
They're not even really giving them a passing grade.
That's right. Yeah, no, it's usually near the bottom of the issue areas. And so the one aspect of that is that certainly explains the incentive to come back and do it again. The challenge, of course, and we said this at the beginning, was, you know, for Abbott, you know, again, he constrained what he was saying. He's not saying go back and put more money on the homestead exemption. He said, no, I want you to essentially change the curve here, change the slope of the line in terms of what the local entities are collecting. And this is this thing, this revenue growth cap. And the thing is that, you know, the revenue growth cap, the trigger at which point the voters have to approve it, was already moved from about, I think it was 8 or 8.5%, and they got moved back to 3.5%, which is a huge drop. And now the issue is well, let's put it back more. And without going into all the details, you know, one of the things that I think should be obvious to everybody is there's not a lot of room between 0 and 3.5. Just
right. And everybody that was, you know, that was following the way that this blew up in, mm-hmm, you know, first in the House and then became an, you know, unresolvable, you know, tension between the House and the Senate in the final days of the second session, was very notable. Yeah. And the problem here really was within the Republican caucus. I mean, there was subsequently disagreement between the House and the Senate, but ultimately, the problem was within the Republican caucus in the House.
That's right. And look, you know, you can say what you want about, you know, who, you know, you can look at data and we can kind of like try to tease out, you know, who the quote unquote offenders are, you know, in terms of local entities who are, you know, just blowing up their tax rates over the last number of years or over the period of which it's spurred this response. But the reality is the politics of this have always been front and center, which are always, you know, there's always been a population threshold. And for the most part, policies that are meant to ratchet back local collection have never really been targeted at smaller communities, smaller counties, counties mostly represented by Republicans, counties and small towns. These policies have mostly been directed at Austin, at Houston, at Dallas, to a lesser extent at Fort Worth, at the big cities and at their sort of large suburbs. And so to some extent, you know, this is the one of the ways this went off the rails, and it's kind of always been hanging out there, was someone said, well, wait a minute, if fiscal, you know, conservatism is good for Austin, why isn't it good for Lubbock? Why isn't it good for Coryell County? Whatever. And honestly, and this is, you know, the nature of legislation, you know, a million stories are told this way. Once that vote makes it to the floor, it's kind of hard for a lot of people to say no. And obviously for the Democrats, who might be kind of generally negatively predisposed to this, knowing it's going to pass, it's actually a delicious chance to say, oh, no, you guys get to do this too now. Now, the issue, of course, and I think this is the political science side of this, and I think this is the future piece of this, you know, if they do end up doing something like this, the problem is that, you know, if you do set the rollback rate to 1%, what it means is that you have local elections over every single budget. I mean, basically, that's where this leads at a certain point, because ultimately, you know, counties, cities, they contract with outside individuals. They are also dealing with inflation, which is runs higher than 1% on a normal basis. And so ultimately, as a tool to sort of, you know, slap the cities or slap the counties, eventually voters are just going to be voting to approve whatever the budget is. And the other thing is, this is what you're starting to see, and it's really interesting if you're paying attention to this, is that if you are going to go for a rollback rate election, you may as well really go for it. And that's the thing. Like, it's not like these cities and counties and towns are like, well, we want to raise revenue by 3.65% over. No. That's not what they're asking for. And it's not what they're going to ask for, because they know that if they're going to go to the voters and ask for it, they may as well ask for more, because if they can get it based on either the election type or the types of issues they're pushing, you know, whatever they're promising to give back, what you're doing is you're setting a new source of set of revenue numbers that's significantly higher that you get to work off of next time.
Right. And in you know, practical terms, you know, if you're going to have to go to the well, you might as well, you know, go with a big bucket.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And you know, there's obviously, as we're seeing, there's political risk in that. And I it's interesting to see, and I've been kind of back processing this as we've had several conversations about this. You know, watching that floor debate, there was an interesting element of, you know, this new, more populist brand of conservatism, right? Because what we're describing is a kind of impractical form of direct democracy.
Yep.
If you're going to have, you know, people in every town of every size have a direct election on any economic budget decision of consequence.
Well, and as people pointed out, it's probably going to cost more than you're going to save in most cases.
Well, that's
just to
right.
run especially, those elections. I mean, which is
especially, and that's where if you go down to 1%, it's just like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it actually eats itself. It's so.
And I think that argument took hold in some interesting corners, near as I can tell, from the discussions that were heard. But that, you know, that kind of, again, kind of small D Democratic versus small R Republican principle of government.
Yeah.
In terms of direct democracy versus saying, look, we elect people to make these decisions. Is an interesting turn of events.
Well, and I don't know people's hearts. I don't know their motivations, but I really thought, you know, when Abbott put this on the agenda, there was no way they were going to be able to do it. And part of it goes back to just what we're talking about, right? I mean, just look at the basics, right? They had just committed $50 billion, I think, more, you know, to more homestead exemption increases. You know, so there was no money to throw at it. So the only thing they could do is turn the screws on the local entities. And they'd already turned the screws on the local entities pretty aggressively. I should also point out that one of the other pieces of, you know, Texas budget, you know, local budgets now, is they can't decrease their police budgets. So there's also an upward pressure on their budgets anyway that has been created by the legislature. So, you know, I think a lot of this to some extent was, you know, just to be fair about the politics, as Abbott says, hey, I asked them for more. I mean, look, we delivered a ton. I'm being aberrant. We delivered a ton, but, you know, I asked them for more and, you know, couldn't do it, you know, next time. And he gets to say, hey, I tried. But I honestly think that that's about kind of where that was – that landed kind of where it was likely. And the fact that it went off the rails as much as it did was in some ways a reflection of the fact that there was almost nowhere for it to go but off the rails.
Yeah, no, I think that's I think that's fair. And I'm very curious to see where this issue is going to go. And, you know, the police budget component is an interesting political piece, given that you're pitting two, you know, one overarching national theme of law and order and policing against, you know, what is one of the most localized issues that you could see, right?
Yeah.
Even though it's also a central plank of Republican politics right now. And frankly, you know, I think it's, you know, it's also fair to notice that once again, there were no small share of Democrats that in that result on the importance of property taxes in the legislature, right? I mean, you know, nobody really wants to pay a bunch of property taxes, and that gets us to, or, you know, wants to pay the level of property taxes that Texans are paying. And it does get to another longstanding macro issue of the sources of revenue in the state.
Yeah, and I think it does speak, you know, I mean, one of the things we're not going to talk about during this podcast, but, you know, sort of the continued, you know, it's sort of, it led in the rollout, but the sort of continued negative economic perceptions. And the thing is that, you know, if your home's value is staying relatively steady and your income is staying relatively steady, but the cost of everything else is going up, well, then, you know, the impact of your housing and your property tax costs on your overall quality of life is actually getting worse, even as your property taxes maybe aren't going up as much as they were. So it just makes it as one of the major expenses that people are going to have, housing, and it folds into housing. It's just front and center for a lot of people in a way that I think, you know, it's just, you know, again, you can't just sort of, you can't brush it away very easily.
Well, and I think, you know, it's a good point. It, you know, that's a good connection. And I think it really points to kind of the other, one of the major themes in the poll that we emphasize in the rollout and that has been brewing. And that is, you know, the persistence of concerns about the economy and in particular, the persistence of concerns about what we'll broadly call, you know, kind of core costs of living.
Yeah, core cost of living is good.
You know, in the sense that, you know, the top economic concerns that we saw were, you know, the prices of everyday goods, the cost of healthcare,
cost
of housing that you flagged.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's the other kind of essential element of the, you know, the big, you know, the big overall picture of the electorate and of public opinion in the state that we saw in the poll.
Yeah, it's hard to feel like you're doing well when you're getting less. Even if the numbers are the same.
And I think that's part of, you know, for people that are aware of property taxes, or even if they're not, when you ask them what's important, you know, anything that kind of, you know, resonates with those other really overarching concerns that, you know, frankly was not, you know, a major theme of this legislative session. And they can't do everything. And there was a lot on the table, obviously.
Right.
You know, before we escape this, we should, and I want to talk about how the leaders are doing. But we haven't really talked about attitudes on redistricting, and I think we should at least touch on that, since it was such a major theme of the session. It was one of the elements that was obviously deeply partisan. It was not surprising to see the partisan split that we saw. Something they did, but something that was, you know, in that under 50% group, you know, it's hard for me not to feel like there is a tension between all of these economic concerns on one hand and, you know, the clearly central, if not instigating role that redistricting played in this.
Yeah. I mean, what's really interesting, I mean,
and by this, I mean, the calling of the special sessions.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting, you know, we asked this, you know, we have a news battery in the poll and we asked people, you know, how much they've heard about a series of state and national political stories. And, you know, when it comes to the special session, about, I think 47% of people said they'd heard a lot about it, which is actually pretty high for a state level story, but it was still significantly lower than the share who said that they'd heard a lot about redistricting. And it's not to say that, you know, I mean, like, again, you're saying, well, how's that possible? And like, no, it's not confusing at all. You know, people heard about it through national news. They heard through about it through other sources. A lot of people who don't know that Texas has a 104-day legislative session and what a special session is and all that sort of stuff. So it's not crazy. But ultimately, you know, the fact that they were there and the fact, you know, it was known to people, but more known to them was that they were dealing with redistricting. I mean, that was higher on the list of what people were paying attention to. And so, you know, a lot of people are going to come out of this, and we'll kind of come back to this maybe at the end. But, you know, when you say like, well, what was the big thing that came out of, you know, we're talking about all the other issues that kind of came out of the summer. It's like, well, Trump asked them to redistrict and they did. And a lot of people heard about it and they have thoughts. And, you know, overall, on balance, negative, as you said, more negative among Democrats, Republicans, largely okay with it, you know, for the most part. But, you know, it is one of those things where, you know, despite, I mean, what's interesting is despite the fact that, you know, redistricting ended up driving, you know, most of the national coverage and really, in a lot of ways, really driving a lot of the action indirectly or directly in the special session, it was only one thing. I mean, it was only one thing on this huge agenda of items.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's sort of, you know, the interesting piece here to some extent, you know, it's like what, you know, what's going on here and how did it affect everybody? Because obviously, you know, as I said at the top, this is a, you know, this is the governor's agenda. This was chosen for a reason. So, you know, it does sort of raise the question, how did it work out for him?
Yeah. And not to wander too far into media effects, but obviously, you know, as you kind of, you know, got out there, you know, this became a national story because it was a national story in the sense of, as you say, the instigation of this by the White House, which, you know, I think in the legislative debates, you know, the sponsors, you know, the Republican advocates for this were not eager to talk about this, but they couldn't really deny it either.
Yeah.
So you got a lot of kind of when the Democrats brought it up.
Right.
But everybody kind of knew what was going on with that, you know, though they wanted to talk about it in different ways. But from the perspective of the people that were surveying in a public opinion poll, the volume of the coverage as not just your, you know, a run-of-the-mill state legislature story that not a lot of people pay attention to versus a big national story that during this period led coverage in both conservative and progressive and, you know, in basically all news outlets.
No, I'd have to go back and look at prior special sessions, but I'm fairly certain that when we've asked that news coverage or news attention question in prior special sessions, we did not see nearly half of Texans saying they'd heard a lot about it.
And that, yeah, right. And I mean, it was legitimately viewed as a national story. And I guess the point I was going to make is that also, you know, one that very easily fits into a partisan frame in terms of both elite queuing, not to set you up too baldly, but also, you know, pre-existing partisanship.
Right.
And I think where that was evident in interesting ways in the poll is when, you know, we asked, do you approve or disapprove of the effort in Texas, basically?
Yeah.
And then the follow-up, well, how do you feel about it in other states?
Right.
You know, you got a lot more ambiguity as soon as you introduced this kind of other, you know, the more partisan battle that has emerged from this.
Yeah.
Or that this is part of, I think, is a fair way of putting it. Not to stomp on the Democratic line when they came back.
But yeah.
That this is a, you know, this is a national partisan fight that has become, okay, well, if Republicans are going to do it in Texas, well, then we're going to do it in a way that favors Democrats in California. Well, then we're going to, you know, do it in Ohio and this
yeah, well,
you know, kind of domino effect that we're seeing, you know, that was more complicated.
Well, yeah, and I think that's, you know, I mean, you did a good job. I think you handled writing that initial draft in the rollout post. I mean, it is an interesting thing here because Democrats are kind of in a weird spot. Right.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, you know, they sort of reflexively, you know, are you know, I would say negatively disposed towards this idea of redistricting, maybe of gerrymandering. I don't want to say like that Republicans aren't per se.
Well, no, I was going to say, because, you know, if you look at those results, there's also a lot of ambivalence among Republicans when you ask about the national.
And that's exactly right. And I think
echoes.
And that's the thing that's sort of tricky here is, you know, so for it's not just tricky for Democratic voters, it's tricky for the Democratic response. I mean, right now, you know, there's sort of a general, and I'll just make a general observation that you can apply to this, which is there seems to be a lot of people on one side, both sides, using some kind of argument that goes along the lines of, well, the other side has been doing X for years, or the other side doesn't follow this particular set of rules, or the other side doesn't follow this norm. So therefore, we're not going to either. And it's sort of taken as like a self-evident, you know, truth that that's a good thing, or that that somehow is responding to what voters want, or that that might be what voters want. And I think Democrats are having a lot more of this conversation than Republicans right now. But I think what these results kind of point to is, like, you know, in most cases, these are complicated questions. If people have views on them, they're probably developed over some period of time. They're probably supported by other views about what the process normatively ought to look like. And it's not the case that, you know, I think everybody involved is just like, well, okay, you know, you broke this rule. Now it's my turn to break this rule. And everybody's just going to say, yeah, that's what the game we're playing now. And this is going to shake out over time. But these, you know, results kind of scratch at that complexity, I think, that's going on here.
And it adds, you know, more to results that we've seen in the past and that we saw in this poll related to, you know, going to some kind of independent commission, et cetera.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we've always seen plurality support for, you know, basically making redistricting a quote unquote nonpartisan affair to some extent. I mean, you know, to the extent you can do that, you know, the thing I think that will be interesting to see, and I think this is, you know, the only reality we know right now is that this may or may not spur a broader national discussion about, you know, the way that we construct our political districts. My suspicion is that it's not going to go anywhere, because ultimately it requires people in power giving up the power to draw those districts. And that's just not something that, you know, really anybody wants to do in most cases. And in Texas in particular, we don't have any citizen-led way to generate any sort of mechanism like that. And in a lot of states, you don't. And so if that's the case, this is kind of where we're at right now, but, you know, we'll see. I'm skeptical that it's going to matter. I'm not saying in the political sense, but like in the sense of people's views about the process and everything else, just because I feel like when people think that these rules are really going to rile people up, I very rarely think that that ends up being true.
Yeah. I mean, I might even take a slightly more dour or cynical view of that, which is that, you know, I don't see in the current configuration of our national politics and the current, you know, I'll just stick with that for now. You know, it's kind of the worst of both worlds in that I think the dynamic you're talking about is in play.
Yeah.
And I guess what makes me even more cynical is that it is going to be in, or makes me characterize this view as cynical, is that it is going to be in play, even though it's institutionally a very bad and untenable place to be.
Yeah, I think that's
right.
You know,
in the sense that if the new norm is going to be, well, you know, if we have control of the legislature and we think we can tweak the maps in our favor, we're just going to do it. It's just, you know, it's hard for me to understand that as being anything other than dysfunctional and degrading.
Well,
you know, it's a,
I go even further, you know, dysfunctional and degrading. And I mean, this is a topic I'd like to discuss on another podcast, but then layer that in. If somehow the way that power develops in the state is that now the state party gets to decide which members get to run in party in the primary elections based on a selective canvassing of votes that they took in the legislature. All of a sudden now you've got an unelected party organization determining which members of the party need to vote which way on which key pieces of bills while they're changing the electoral maps. I mean, there's a lot of problems kind of floating around out there that this all kind of gets to in a really direct way. And I mean, and I don't think you need to be a conspiracy theorist or anything else. Because, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on out there.
No, look, you know, to my mind, you know, conspiracy theory is a simplification in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's an attractive oversimplification of deep structural dysfunction.
Yeah. Well,
as a proposition.
Okay.
Very good. So, you know, this does bring us then to, you know, you've already channeled Governor Abbott.
Yeah, let me
verbally.
Do it. Yeah.
You know, to where we are with, you know, what we also found in the leadership amidst all of this and public views of the leadership. And, you know, for state leaders, this, you know, was another poll suggest, this was a, well, I won't say another, but this was a poll suggesting, you know, some erosion of satisfaction with the leadership in the state amidst all of this conflict, both, you know, I mean, I think it's not just put it this way. I think this is partially attributed to polarization, partially attributable to, you know, underlying intra-party conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also just, you know, what a rough and ugly institutional summer it's been during these special sessions.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, just to put
talk to us a little about what we're talking about.
Yeah, let me put the numbers.
Before I offer multiple explanations, I guess we should look at the numbers.
No, this is fun. I like this. It's like a bingo game. Okay. You know, if we look at, you know, the governor and we look at his job approval ratings, what we saw was, you know, 40% of Texans approved of the job he's doing as governor. That is an all-time low in his approval ratings. Going back to October of 2014, I counted that's 47 surveys in all. So that's, you know, this is a rich time series. The 50% of Texans disapproving of his job performance matches an all-time high in the time series, which was in August 2021. You know, notably around some special sessions again. And I think that's part of, you know, I think one of the pieces to this here. If we look under the hood a little bit, you know, Republicans still obviously overwhelmingly support the governor, 76% approve of the job he's doing, 14% disapprove. High, though not as high as he has been with this group, speaking of intra-party issues. Among Democrats, 89% disapprove, only 7% approve. And that may not sound surprising, but honestly, you know, there were periods in Abbott's tenure where he could see approval from 15-20% of Democrats in a given poll. So that's pretty low. Among independents, 19% approve, 55% disapprove. So, I mean, I think, you know, and I think if you take a look at the trend chart on our website, you know, you'll really see kind of how stark this is. Because honestly, for the most of Abbott's tenure, he's, you know, his approval has outstripped his disapproval most of the time. He's very rarely been underwater in the poll. And again, it's 47 surveys, so it's not, you know, a drop in the bucket. This is both, you know, again, a disapproval high and approval low, and, you know, now the widest gap in debt approval that we've seen in his polling. And it's hard not to think that the special session and his sort of role kind of at the center of it had some factor to play. I mean, I think we've spent a lot of time talking about the nationalization, you know, both of the legislature and of the sort of Texas political scene during the summer. Abbott, you know, ultimately embraced it in a way that I think, you know, our polling indicates is not problematic to him with his voters. I mean, we asked a question about Donald Trump's influence on a number of actors, you know, the U.S. Republicans in Congress, Greg Abbott, you know, Dan Patrick, John Cornyn, kind of just sort of seen. And I believe, you know, 2/3 of Republicans said that, you know, Donald Trump has about the right amount of influence on Greg Abbott. And so to the extent that, you know, if anybody feels like, well, you know, maybe there'll be some pushback because, you know, Trump is seeming to tell Texas what to do, not indicating in these polling results, but it is the case that, you know, you know, what ultimately turned out to be, outside of the flood relief, for the most part, a hyper-partisan political agenda, yeah. You know, when there really was nothing else to focus on. And that's the thing we got to remember about special sessions, and we got to think about the summer, too. You know, the political stories tend to be less. As you pointed out already, the redistricting drew more attention into the Texas special session than we would normally see. And then the question becomes, you know, if you dig, you know, scratches a little bit below the surface, well, what else are they up to? It's like, oh, yeah, abortion pills, bathroom bill, you know, right. You know, and all this kind of other stuff that's like, you know, and I'm not saying that they didn't also deal with some stuff that people want, but they also didn't reduce property taxes. So it's sort of like, you know, you are asking people to look in and see what the legislature is up to. And ultimately, this was not a representation of what, you know, the electorate is concerned about, because the electorate is concerned about prices. They're concerned about the economy. This was a reflection of what, you know, some Republican primary audiences really care about. And, you know, I think it was received by the electorate, and the governor's received by the electorate in the space, about how you would expect at this point, right?
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, the interesting comparison, you know, looking at that trend data for the governor's job approval ratings, is that the last time he was underwater to this extent, mm-hmm. you know, in other words, the competitor for this, you know, all-time low is during the summer of 2021,
right.
As the COVID response was being nationalized along partisan lines,
right?
And you know that, and you know, interestingly, in terms of what we see going forward and what I think we're seeing already to some degree, you know, the governor responded to that policy-wise in terms of his overall position vis-a-vis the pandemic pretty quickly,
yeah.
And pretty decisively after that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's,
you know,
right.
And I think we probably don't have to go into there, but we saw, you know, very similar trend with Lieutenant Governor Patrick, right?
Yeah, 30% approve of the job that he's doing, which is the same as in June. Again, I think, you know, one of the things we said in the write-up, I'll say, you know, the Lieutenant Governor, after really pushing himself out front, especially on the THC issue. Really, I don't want to say withdrew, because that's too, I mean, he definitely did not withdraw. But in terms of, you know, the public attention really moved to the House because of the quorum breaking Democrats, and to the governor, because the governor was, you know, essentially everyone was looking to the governor to say, okay, well, when are you going to call? What's going to be on the call? What's next? And Patrick really, you know, sort of, like I said, you know, receded to the background a little bit. So his approval numbers stayed the same. The share disapproving increased slightly from 42% to 44%. However, you know, just again, the net approval was negative 14. So the approval minus the disapproval. And that was an all-time low in the time series for the lieutenant governor going back to October of 2015. And the next lowest approval rating was in June. So actually, you know, this has been someone, again, I would suggest look at the time series on the website. We'll put it up in the blog post, I assume.
Yep.
But, you know, you'll see that he's been trending negative, you know, over the summer. And I will say in his case, you know, I mean, this is speculation, but I think, you know, the marijuana is really the most obvious driver of this in a lot of ways. You know, that's an unpopular position he's taken. He knows it's an unpopular position. It splits his voters. And honestly, for a lot of people who might not be paying too much attention, this might have drawn them in a way that, you know, I think orients them to the lieutenant governor in a negative fashion.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say that there was probably to some degree both a strategic and also a practical lowering of his profile after the spike in attention to him in the final days of the regular session over the THC bill.
Right.
Right. And so,
and then, lastly, you know, we have not lastly, but, you know, additionally, you know, we can look at the Speaker of the House.
Thirdly.
Yes. Equally, but thirdly, you know, 18% said that they approved the job that Speaker Burroughs was doing, 34% disapproved. This is, you know, barely changed, I would say, from his June numbers. And, you know, just typical of the Speaker of the House, you know, more than half of Texas voters either were neutral or had no opinion. I think, you know, more, you know, which I think the Speaker would be fine with, you know, overall, right? You know, I'll just say, you know, among Republicans, he was actually, is that right? He's underwater? No, he's overwater. I'm sorry. He's 30.
No, he's okay.
Yeah, sorry. I was looking at the wrong numbers. Yeah, 33 approved, 14 disapproved. You know, which is, I think, honestly, you know, if we've been looking at this stuff for a long time with speakers, that seems about right. You know, it's about where they usually are. You know, more notably, when we look at the legislature overall, 49% of Texans said they disapproved of the job the legislature is doing. Only 29% approved. So that's a net minus 20. That is tied with the August 2021 results at minus 20, which, again, if you were listening really closely, you'll notice that was also Abbott's approval low and his net approval low. The legislature's overall, you know, net disapproval didn't change, or net approval didn't change much. Again, it was negative 20 in August. It was negative 19 in June. But it is really notable here that these numbers are very low. I mean, if we go back over the time series, which goes back, we've been asking about legislative approval since, you know, at least 2011 in this poll. You know, the shared disapproving is at an all-time high. The share approving is not at an all-time low, but pretty near.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, the approval among Republicans of the legislature at 54-22, I think is about the best they can hope for.
Yeah, and then you'd say to yourself, you know, and yet, having complete control of the agenda, majorities in both chambers, you're still at 54-22.
Yeah,
You know.
Well, and I think, you know, this gives, you know, an opportunity to kind of wrap this up a little bit. So, you know, how did you present what is, you know, a lot? What did you see here in terms of how you kind of, you know, give us the non-student version of, you know, how you made sense of this when you did the unpacking the news? I bet you had an interesting take on it.
Well, I mean, I think the first thing, you know, to remember here is that, you know, the election is a long, long time from now.
Well, the general election.
The general election. Yeah, well, that's exactly. But I think, you know, we'll this is how to deal with the students.
Yeah, which to most, you know, which we have to remember, for most people is the election.
Yeah, that's the only election. And so, you know, we did not, you know, we'll talk about this next week. We did not do trial ballots in the poll. I'll probably do a tirade next week about why we didn't do trial ballots in the poll. But part of it is when we ask the news question, fewer than 1 in 5 Texans say that they've heard a lot about the U.S. Senate race. It's at or near the bottom of the list of news stories that they're paying attention to. So we just know that that's like, again, if you listen to this, you're following, you know who's getting in, you know Tallarico got in this week and all this stuff, and it's great, and we've got some numbers. However, the election is so far away. And the reason I just say that is because I think when, you know, these big issues happen, whether it's, you know, it's like, oh my God, we had a mid-decade redistricting, oh my God, they finally passed a bathroom bill, or this, or they didn't pass tax relief, what's going to happen? Well, my thing would be to say, Probably nothing, because there's like a long, long time before the general election and a long, long time still before that before voters are even paying attention. However, I do think the other thing I pointed out is that, you know, this is a pretty good explanation. I mean, when you look at the agenda, I mean, you look at a very political agenda. You look at the governor using his powers very, very effectively to his benefit. You know, I think, you know, you can't walk away from, even though his numbers might be down overall, you can't walk away from this saying that Abbott's not further insulated from whatever kind of challenge he might have faced, as nominal as it probably would be, in a Republican primary.
Right.
And so, you know, thinking about it that way, you know, and part of what I explained to the kids is that, you know, you look at something like flood relief, you had overwhelming support, you had, there was no division, this was easy, they just had to respond, because if they didn't, they would create a less friendly election environment, regardless of what's going on in 2026, if they just didn't respond in some way, or they couldn't point to something they did to respond to the flooding.
And again, not to imply that the politics were the only reason, obviously people...
yeah.
Had legitimate concerns about this.
Oh, no.
This,
and
but the politics make it easier to do.
Well, no. And I say, like, I mean, you can be totally cynical and have that response. You can also just say, hey, that's just responsiveness. The entire electorate said this was important, and so they did it. And that's what they're supposed to do. Otherwise, you're supposed to vote them out. Like, that's how that works. So it's fine. You know, the bathroom bill, the abortion pills, those are things that are, you know, big deals for Republican primary voters, you know, and honestly, kind of contrary to the thrust of overall public opinion in the state. But the next election, as you point out, is the primary election. And as I think I've said many times on this podcast, if not elsewhere, you know, it's not enough for a Republican legislator to go to Austin and come back and say, hey, I didn't expand abortion access. Hey, I didn't put any restrictions on guns. They need to do something. And so they did. You know, they moved the ball forward on those issues because that's something Republican primary voters care about.
Right. Well, and you know, it's also not enough to say, you know, the floods were horrific and tragic, and we all were worried about it, and we did that, and we acted on that. Mm-hmm. That's not enough either at the primary level.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's not 100%. That's right. That's not an issue at the primary level. No one's going to say, well, I don't think you gave enough money to Kerr County in that. You know, it's like, no, that's not.
Unless they didn't do anything.
Right.
And then it would just be piled on top of the other stuff.
Exactly. Right? And so I think, you know, that all makes a fair amount of sense. We already talked about, you know, the marijuana thing just being kind of a loser because there is no clear public sentiment here that explains it. And so I think, you know, you can kind of look across it all and sort of say, you know, it all hangs together, even if it feels kind of random in some sense. You know,
well, I think from our, you know, from the perspective of what we're talking about this week, you know, topic wise, and I felt like we had to kind of inject it a little. The economy is the thing that straddles the two.
Yes.
The two subjects being, you know, a focus on what's going on in the session and our likely focus next week, which is the sentiment about national things going on and elections coming up to the extent that people are thinking about that. But particularly the general, you know, national mood is we record this, you know, this is not, you know, the news today is not going to help.
Right.
And that, you know, we've got another... you know, week of mixed signals from the economic numbers with, you know, employment, you know, seeming to sag and pointing towards making it easier to increase or to reduce interest rates when the Fed meets. But on the other hand, just this morning, new inflation numbers that show that, you know, inflation at the consumer level still seems not entirely tamed.
Right. Yeah.
No, that's a problem.
Well, and that's the thing. I think, you know, you kind of go across all this and you say, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the economy is the economy and it affects everybody. And, you know, you can, I think what's really interesting to me, and we'll talk about this maybe a little bit more next week, but, you know, I think when people have been looking at the analysis of the redrawn congressional districts in Texas, you know, one of the things they pointed out is that the districts redrawn in South Texas, you know, may or may not net those Republican seats, depending on what happens with Hispanics. And I'll say in this poll, the view of Trump among Hispanics got a lot worse than it had been at the beginning of this year. I mean, it's certainly been moving in that direction. And a lot of that's going to be based on economic performance numbers. Yeah. And
that decline has been fairly consistent since the election.
Right. And so, you know, I think that's kind of hanging out there. And I mean, at a broader level, there are people who say, you know, if you really look at, like, if everybody went and gerrymandered, or if, you know, some subset, you know, is it going to change the outcome of the election? And the answer for most of, like, sophisticated analyses is maybe, Maybe, yeah. With a question mark. And part of that goes back to this. And the reason it's a maybe is, well, it kind of depends, because honestly, if people feel like the economy is really bad, if they blame the incumbent party, you know, it's going to probably, you know, it's going to overwhelm some of these efforts.
Right. You know? And I think we just, you know, you take that, you take the institutional politics of the national level with the Trump administration, which are, you know, fairly unprecedented right now. Mm-hmm. I think it's not to get us too into next week. I think it's if you're a professional campaign person, you have to do what you can to anticipate things as best you can. But there's no real way at this point to have a very clear idea of what the general election environment is going to be, given just how much dynamism and flux, you know, how much dynamism there is in the environment right now, and how many relatively unprecedented, or at least conditions that don't have a recent precedent, how that's all going to play out.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think it's madness that anybody that's, you know, saying, I know, is just taking a guess right now. And then we'll have the usual dynamic with the people that get lucky parade around saying they knew it all along, and everyone else is trying to.
Everyone else is going to say, well, I never could have known that this would have happened. It's like, exactly.
Yeah. And that brings us around to, you know, where we started today, which, you know, the killing that took place yesterday is yet another factor in that. Who knows? I have no way of knowing how that's going to play out, but it adds yet another jolt of very sad uncertainty into a very uncertain environment. So, you know, I think we've set ourselves up to talk with Darren next week.
Yeah.
Josh, thanks for being in the studio and doing some digging for this and all the coverage this week as I'm, you know, holed up trying to get better. Much appreciated.
Oh, well, I hope you get better soon. I don't want to do.
I'm sure you do.
No.
No,
I
take that at face value. I appreciate it. And thanks to Will and all the guys in the studio at guys and gals, to be fair, at UT Austin for, you know, helping us manage this podcast this time and at all times. Thanks to you for listening. All the data that we've talked about, and much more from the latest poll and all the trend data, I think is becoming increasingly relevant, can be found at texaspolitics.utexas.edu, both in the post with this podcast, if you're listening on another platform, but throughout the website. We have a great search tool, very easy to find in our newly redesigned website. So thanks to all of you for listening. And we will be back next week with our colleague Darren Shaw for another Second Reading podcast. Take care, y'all. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.